Hi, welcome to Someone Else's Movie, the original podcast where an actor, writer, director, or nebulous industry figure gives a little love to a movie they didn't make. I'm Norm Wilner, senior film writer for Now Magazine, and this is the other thing I do. My guest this week is Antoine Bourges, a filmmaker who broke out with East Hastings Pharmacy, a study of transactional relationships at a Vancouver methadone dispensary, which was named Best Canadian Documentary at the Doxa Festival in 2013. His first feature is Fail to Appear, a closely observed drama about a young social worker trying to help a troubled man through the court system in Toronto. It's streaming on Mubi right now, but it's going offline tomorrow, Wednesday, June 6th. However, if you're in Toronto, it's opening theatrically at the TIFF Bell Lightbox Thursday, June 7th, and it's very much worth your time. Antoine picked La Captive, Chantal Ackerman's austere take on Marcel Proust's La Prisonnière. I apologize in advance for my constant mutilation of French things. Starring Stanislas Mérard and Sylvie Testud, it's a psychological study of a young man obsessed with control, the young woman upon whom he most desires to exert it, and the unspoken bargain between them. Less beholden to Proust than to Ackerman's own filmography, it's a spare, considered, almost minimalistic reinterpretation of the text, and one that lines up very well with Antoine's own filmmaking aesthetic. Oh, and Dexter was in the studio with us, and you're probably going to hear him snoring here and there. I'm sorry. Antoine liked having him around, and this is someone else's movie.
I just love the film, and I think it had sort of the kind of effect that I like the most that films can have, where it's like I watched it the first time and I like it, but I'm not quite sure why, and I certainly don't rewatch it or even consider rewatching it. And then time goes by, and I just realize that, or just remember this film that I saw, it just stays with me, and then I watch it again. This is sort of like the best way for me to really enter a film, strangely, is just to not completely connect with it the first time.
That's interesting, but it pulls on you.
But it definitely pulls on me, yeah. And because I've grown to really love, you know, Chantal Ackerman's work. But when I saw La Captive, it was the first film I'd seen of her.
Okay.
And I didn't really know about her. I just kind of watched that film, and when I rewatched it, I had seen her sort of like more monumental, like the classic sort of 70s film that she had made, and so obviously I watched it differently.
Yeah, I have to admit, I came to Ackerman late. I don't think I saw her stuff until my mid-20s.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw...
That's not so late for me. I'm late in film, I feel, so it's okay.
No. But how old are you?
When I watched La Captive, yeah. I was 21, I think. But then when I watched the other films, yeah, I must have been like 23 or something like that. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, my first experience was Jean Guillaume, I'm sure I'm mispronouncing it on some level. And then I think Jutuil, and then this. Mm-hmm. And this was theatrical. This was when it was released.
Oh, right, okay.
So I was already in my early 30s.
Right.
And I watched it again just the other day, mm-hmm. in preparation for this, because I hadn't seen it since.
Mm-hmm.
And it's amazingly of the moment now. Like, it's really... It's a film about male entitlement and
right.
objectification, and we're not supposed to really empathize with anyone, I mm-hmm. don't think. Maybe her, but maybe not.
Yeah, well, it's... Yeah, it's strange, because I think definitely seeing it, like, I rewatched it the other day too, just to remember it, but it's strange, because for me I instantly forget the moment, like, the even though it's easy when you watch the film and you see his behavior, and it's obviously like something that today is you know, it's odd to say the least, but somehow as you watch the film you forget that, and you sort of connect with him and her, and the fact that they kind of both, I mean, we can talk about it more, but like,
of course,
they
yeah.
both sort of get off on that.
Yeah, I mean, it's absolutely a mutually frustrating and exploitative relationship.
Mm-hmm.
The title notwithstanding, there's really no question that they're both in it willingly.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is just so... I mean, the great thing about cinema, period, the great thing about film is that you can eavesdrop on people,
right?
In a way that artificial or documentary, in a way that's revelatory and illuminates something about our own experience. Mm. But Ackerman's approach to this is just to frame them like specimens. Mm. You know, so much of it is spent waiting for them to move on each other or speak to each other. There are long stretches of just not so much contemplation as observation. They're like subjects.
Yeah. I feel like it's an odd combination of observation and but also complete awareness on every side. Like, the actors seem completely overly conscious and aware of their acting, and you're kind of reminded that they're acting all the time. Like, it is stylized. So it's odd to feel like you're also observing something that seems so controlled, but you do, which is also what's kind of fascinating.
Well, we're just drawn, I mean, it can't help but be drawn into the narrative, because so much of it plays out in relative silence, that we're looking closer.
Yeah.
And when there's nothing to hear, we start to fill in. You have the instinct to complete the film for yourself while you're watching it, before it reveals everything, before we really know what's going on. Mm-hmm. And I mean, certainly in Jean Dielman's, silence and inactivity or stasis is so much of a part of her storytelling.
Right.
That when I saw this, I thought, oh, obviously it's an extension of it, except that it really isn't, because there's so much more happening here behind people's eyes and in motion, and where they go and what they do is more important than the relationship between them, because that seems ultimately fixed and unchanging.
Right.
In mutual dependence.
Yeah. No, yeah, I think the one common element for me with Jean Dielman in this film and a lot of her films, I think, is the importance of routine and just having this system that helps you cope with life. And this time, it's not the system of a house of a stay at home mom. It's the system of this couple and just all the roles that they've established. When that breaks down, then you know that it's tragic.
Yeah. Oh, right into paranoia.
Yeah, yeah.
Just raging paranoia. Yeah. And again, that's where I started thinking this. I mean, it's based on a book that predates cinema.
Right.
If I'm getting the year right, and now we have something that's utterly relevant to the present situation. Which is just sad and also somehow true. Like there's a deeper honesty in the ugliness of the behavior here, somehow.
Yeah, I mean, it's because she's so willing to engage in this system. I don't completely read it like this even today, but it's maybe I should rethink it. But definitely, I mean, I feel and the scenes that are the most sort of subversive, and that would be very subversive if they were made today, were actually in the book too, and they're described exactly like that. So it is interesting that it was made so long ago. But yeah, I mean, the whole book is very ahead of its time in a way. The way it talks about homosexuality and just dealing with others and people that are different from hiding the fact that you're different from others, basically, and trying to understand others when you really when sometimes it's impossible, the way that he tries to understand her.
Yeah.
and it's just kind of it's impossible. She's an unknown. She's from a different gender, and he just cannot get there.
Yeah, and he, instead of asking her, right? He immediately fetishizes her. One of the earliest scenes in the film, the first conversation that we really see is the bathtub shower thing, where they are separated, perpetually.
Yeah.
And it's a great visual image.
Yeah.
And in the book, it was different bedchambers or something, wasn't it? Mm-hmm. They don't even converse. But that image is so striking. And, because of the nudity, is also transgressive and instantly, I mean, that's why it's on the cover of the British DVD. When I'd already seen the film when the disc arrived in the world, but it's like, oh yeah, that makes perfect sense. That's how you sell this movie.
Yeah, yeah, of course. It's such an odd space.
Yeah, as cynically and alluringly as possible. Mm. But it is what the film is about. Two people who are absolutely intimate with one another but can't connect.
Yeah, and And I think the pleasure in that, at least for him, or it's clearer to see it from his point, because he gets most of the screen time and it's a little bit more about him. But the pleasure, I think, that he gets from this distance that he creates himself, like,
sure, yeah,
like you said, she sleeps in a separate room. She is in this. She sleeps in this sort of day bed. It's not quite a bed. Every night she's like, "Do you want me to come in? Can you come into your room?" He says, "Oh, I'm not sure." And then he goes to his room and he calls her. He's like, "Okay,
yeah.
Okay, now you can." And it's this weird. He likes this distance. I think that's what he. I feel like he doesn't quite know what to do with her if she was just fully there, and his only source of pleasure and to really even have a sensitive appreciation of her and her femininity is to see her through this glass or through this distance or be, you know, sort of press against her when she's asleep and
yeah, and yeah. Recount it to her later.
Yeah, yeah,
recount it to her. Like, yeah. I did all these things to you.
Yeah,
And she says, "Well, that's fine." She's not torturing him. I was trying to figure it out this time through. Just mm-hmm. There's complicity, and then there's consent, and then there's all these other levels in between. But he does seem happiest when he is pushing her away, like when he's mm-hmm. resisting her.
Yeah.
And I realize, like, we've been talking about them for however many minutes and haven't even mentioned their names yet, because right. It doesn't even matter. They're just elemental. Him and her.
Mm-hmm.
And there are other characters in the film, but they don't really factor in.
Yeah.
Even when someone is stealing her away, it's not essential to their relationship. And his greatest desire is to know where she is at all times, even though that's not healthy for anyone.
Yeah.
But it works for them.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
Yeah, I think that he wouldn't like it any other way. I think that he needs her to be sort of impenetrable, and he needs her to sort of try to escape him in some way to want her. He would not want her if she was completely available and completely transparent. But I think she also gets off on being in a relationship with a person who is like that. She wants him to be like this. When he tells her, like you said, when you were asleep, I just parted your legs and I looked at you and I smelled you and all this stuff. And yeah. She's just like, yeah, that's fine. Like, you're silly. Of course it's fine. And right up until, you know, the breakup or his attempt at breaking up,
right.
or who knows what he's really trying to do. It really seems like she would not like it any other way until the very end, I think, where it's actually too much for her. Mm-hmm. I think that's sort of the breaking point. Simon, her, Ariane.
But they are just the he and she of the story. There is a larger world, but we barely see it. I mean, It's a depopulated film. There's almost no one else there.
Yeah, and
even in the city.
Absolutely. And I think that's what really kind of impressed me and really stayed with me the very first time I saw it, because I was actually back. I lived in Paris again around that time, and I watched it there. And I was seeing Paris in a way that looked like clearly like Paris, like the city was. Like there were actually some like signs of like Place de la Concorde, Place Vendôme, like you recognize it, but at the same time it's completely abstracted. It's an abstract Paris. She chose locations where the color of the stone was kind of the same, and so it has this sort of white kind of pristine quality. And you're right, she kind of evacuates. There's no extra, there's no background, there's no and the abstraction is almost in every element of the film, in the acting, in the way that the sequences follow each other. There's kind of a dreamlike quality to it.
And the relationship takes on a sort of dream logic after a while too, because even though they're not responding to one another the way we assume human beings will,
mm-hmm.
they understand it themselves. It's like the logic of something that has been. There are rules they're following that we may not understand, but they get them and they're following them perfectly.
Right. Yeah. And I think that's what's so.
Yeah, I apologize. The dog is snoring. Neither of us is snoring.
No.
Dexter has fallen asleep.
That's very soothing, actually.
Never been much for French cinema.
But that's I forgot what I was saying.
Oh, we were talking about rules.
Yeah, but yeah, no, that's what I think was also so moving, or what was kind of stayed with me when I first watched the film, is that I could not understand these characters and what their motivations. And somehow in the last third of the film, when he basically tries to get her, win her back by breaking up with her. So starting from that point of the film, I strangely completely understood both of them, but in a way that was almost sort of magical or transcendent. Like, it kind of transcended the sort of description of what was happening. I just kind of understood why she was so passive and why she was reacting to him, to his decision like this, and why he wanted to break up but still physically accompany her everywhere after, until he was like, okay, actually let's stay together. I completely, there's something very, in a way, very simple about like very childish about the way they behave that I completely connected with at that point.
It also explains to me, I think, the childishness of it is you've hit it. It's not, while it is clearly a sexual relationship, it isn't a sexual relationship. It doesn't feel like it. There are no waves of attraction, and there's no sense that they even like each other, really. But if it's an elaborate framework that they've constructed so they don't have to face the depths of their feelings, or at least so he doesn't have to face the depths, because I'm not sure she really worries about it that much. And maybe that's the bargain between them, the only way to maintain balance with someone who's so needy is just to not give.
Right.
And then somehow pretend that you hold all the cards.
I think it's sort of a perfect combination of people, and at the same time it's also doomed to explode at some point.
But I think it's never gonna work.
I mean, that's what makes it sort of like this great combination of like art film / melodrama or whatever it should be labeled. Like, it just starts already, you kind of see it, you know where it's going, kind of thing.
Yeah, they don't make films like this with happy endings. And Ackerman especially, she was never one for settling things and everyone, you know, better than they were when they began.
Yeah.
It's an interesting perspective, too, because a woman is making this film, and she's absolutely merciless towards both the male and female leads, but adapting Proust, who was such a fundamentally male writer, not in terms of masculinity, but in terms of his insecurities and his self-doubt. Women simply weren't allowed to write like that when he wrote the books. And I'm probably just punching above my weight here. I'm not really going to do this justice. But it's a strange proposition to take on something like this and come off with a film that is as contemporary and as inartful is the wrong word, but unself-conscious in its depiction of, it's just simply a straight adaptation of the narrative. We're allowed to figure out the themes, we're allowed to lay in the rest of it. And then I look at something like Raul Ruiz's Time Regained, it's just, he was trying so hard to replicate the artistic thrust of reading Proust, and Ackerman just makes it hers and doesn't care. She does more justice to it, I think, that way, by simply recounting it.
Yeah. Well, because I think what's amazing about Proust is that it is like his impulse, his obsession is to kind of exhaust or go to the bottom of everything he describes, everything he tries to explore, and whether it's an object or a relationship or a man or the way someone laughs at a joke, like he will just write as much as he can until he's sort of exhausted it. It's almost like this weird obsession, and that's, but he's so good at it that it's very pleasant. I think that where she, I think you're right, the way that she's, where she does, where she makes a good choice is to understand that she's dealing with cinema, and that's not what cinema does. Mm-hmm. Like, cinema, if anything, it takes pleasure in precisely the opposite, in the opacity, the opaqueness of real life, of the way things sort of, the way you cannot quite penetrate, you know, people, and you can't really read and understand people. And it's such an interesting companion piece to the book because you're right, they do completely different things. Mm-hmm. She gives you sort of the negative of the book. It's
yeah. And they reach the same end very effectively, but mm-hmm. not in any similar way.
Right.
You're just left alone with your thoughts here instead of being carried along by the prose.
Yeah, definitely. It's interesting because the ending, well, I don't know if I should spoil this or not. I mean, are we assuming that people have seen it?
Yeah, so, I mean, you can be, well, it's up to you. You can be as vague as you like, or you can be as direct as you like.
No, but I was going to say, well, I don't know if I can talk about this now. but yeah, no, there's elements of the end of the film that are, I mean, the end of the film is not like the end of the book, but it's like, it's close to the end of what inspired the true story that inspired the book, what happened to Proust, which I only found out very recently when we discussed doing this. I was like, well, I'll look a little bit more into it. And so I'm not going to spoil it, but one difference with the book that I think is interesting is that she's really, I think the film really focuses on this idea that this fusion between a man and a woman in a couple is impossible, and what better way to look at this than to, you know, observe a man who is obsessively trying to completely know everything about this woman, and this woman whose sort of motto is precisely to have this distance. The book, I think. In the book, she has other, the character of Ariane Albertine in the book has other facets where he actually, at many points in the book, grows tired of her, which in the film you don't really see. He's constantly obsessed with her. He sees other women that he finds more attractive, and he wonders whether should I leave her, should I not leave her. And when he breaks up with her in the book, it's actually because he's tired of her, and she tells him a story about she mentions like knowing this person who is this other woman who he knows is in his circle to be a woman who loves women, and instantly he becomes jealous, and he's like, okay, forget it, let's not break up, let's stay together. And I think the theme in Proust is not, it is about this fusion, this impossibility of fusion, but I think it's also this idea that is it possible to love, is love just a form of jealousy, basically? Is there anything else but jealousy in love? Here it's just more about sort of the sickness that jealousy is, and just following this man just
yeah, the film is about being consumed,
exactly.
And how it expresses itself once she is off with her with a woman, mm-hmm. he becomes obsessed with finding out how that works.
Yeah,
and it's incredibly naive and again pre-sexual, childish. He's not fully comprehending things. He badgers a gay couple that he meets, mm-hmm. two women, and asks how it works. Literally, you know, like, how does that go?
Yeah,
and it's fascinating because it reveals his limitations in a way that is clearly unconscious.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Ackerman is aware of it, but he has no idea what he's doing by asking these questions. It's fascinating because it's the most honest expression of himself we've seen, and it's simply that he is completely at sea. He doesn't know how to navigate the world. He can't, I mean, obviously now the answer is just, you know, look it up on the internet, but In the setting of the film, the only option he has is to go find two women sitting together and go through those questions like, do you kiss, do you love each other, are you in a relationship, how does that work? And it's amazing. It's like watching a 6-year-old try to navigate a shopping mall. He's just completely out to lunch.
And it's his stubbornness that is so childish to me too, because he will never stop, and it's this unknown sexuality that to some extent, I mean, I can't say I could find the answer. I mean, the technical answer, of course, but the true feeling is just completely unattainable for me as a man, and I can deal with that, and but maybe I can deal with that because I choose to live a little bit detached from the things that truly matter, and a film that is so romantic and that follows someone who is so obsessed with this woman kind of reminds you that, like, no, you don't understand this, but like, like, why doesn't it bother you more that you don't understand this?
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Because it bothers this guy a lot.
Yeah, the lack of self-awareness is fascinating.
Yeah.
That you can be so certain, that he can be so certain of his love and his desire being pure and true, not pure in a positive sense, but just unfiltered and undiluted by the world, that the only thing he wants is to be with this woman who doesn't want to be with him at the moment anyway, and has embarked on a new relationship which he now has to clarify and quantify and codify in order to understand, so that he can then ignore it and disrupt it and try to get in the way. I don't know if she
doesn't want to be with him.
Well, but if she's with someone else in the moment.
Oh, right, right. Oh, yeah, yeah, no, absolutely. To her. Yeah, yeah, when he... Yeah.
To him, too.
No, that's true. Yeah, and what you said about the questioning, the interrogating of this woman, that's something that I also only noticed when I rewatched it, is how much it looks like... it feels so much like a detective film, in a way. Just for the beginning with the car chase and, like, just following her. The music also kind of the sort of... has this like Hitchcockian quality where he's just kind of like following her, interrogating these women, and yeah, there's so many elements of I mean, some of the shots look like a noir film with the long shadows and everything, but he's like a detective of feelings, like he's trying to find out this answer that is ultimately what do you guys feel, like
he's looking for his own. He's looking for his own motivation. He's looking for hers and theirs and everyone's, and he can't. And when he's given the answers, he can't understand them.
Mm-hmm.
So it's funny. This time through, I was thinking about Cachet,
right?
And Haneke and his choices in Paris to shoot similar anonymous angles, but angles that feel like surveillance. And here we're watching someone surveil someone else.
Yeah, yeah.
And a reasonably bad job of it because he loses her a few times.
Yeah,
and. The whole thing is about him being unable to capture her or the essence of her. And even when she, she clearly has surrendered herself to him in the first movement of the film, they've already established that. He still doesn't know what to do with it.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, I think he's an extremist.
Yeah.
And so in the beginning when she does that, I think the first moment when things start to crack a little bit is when she tells him they get into bed that first night, and she says something like, oh yeah, and then I went to the pool today, and he just kind of stops, like they were about to embrace, and he says, oh wait, I didn't know you went to the pool today. And then that's, so already the routine or like every kind of expectation is like, oh no, that's not what I thought was going to happen. And it's fascinating that like something so small like this, because it's so delicate, it's so small, and it starts to break the, you know, his whole plan. Like he's all about control, like he like something kind of went out of this control. But strangely, that's why I think the film is so interesting. That strangely, that's also why he stays with her. He wouldn't stay with her if she didn't have this little there's a hint of maybe a betrayal.
Yeah, you know? Yeah. He'd be bored.
Yeah, no.
If he knew she was faithful,
yeah,
it's the drive to make sure she's faithful that keeps him going. But yeah, it's, the film functions almost entirely as a metaphor for every relationship ever in the world. Yeah. If you watch it as strictly for its plot, you can't relate to it at all. I mean, that's what's so interesting about it to me, is that it is, as you say, it's a sort of film that is almost off-putting at the beginning.
Yeah,
because why would I even want to spend 2 hours with these people? They seem awful.
Yeah.
But the more I spend with them, the more I'm drawn in.
It's weird. Yeah. It's a very cerebral film. At the same time, it's very reptilian. It's both. It's very, very good. It operates at such a high level and then at such like very base, like id level. And it's sort of catches you off guard, or like that's how I felt it the first time, like I said before. Really catches you off guard. But I think that's what I love also about the acting in the film, and the type of the type of performances that especially the two main characters, because there is it's all about precision and it's all about delivering lines in a way that is very is the opposite of Proust in a way. There's not that much, they don't say that much, but it's very rehearsed and very staged, and does not feel natural at all. I'm not sure how well that reads in a foreign language, but I'm pretty sure it probably reads also a little bit stilted. But then the actors find, these two actors at least find a way to, they find this kind of crack within the rules and the rigidity of what they have to do, and they infuse a lot of life. Mm-hmm. But it's like this precision allows for a certain freedom. Like the freedom comes from the rules, basically. And what I found interesting, again watching it again, is this, that when you see a secondary character, the actress who plays André, she doesn't do a terrible job, but she, I think you can, that's where I could see how difficult I think it is to perform this way, and how good these two actors are, because I could see in some scenes that she doesn't quite pull off this sort of combination. She manages the sort of theatricality, but she doesn't. I felt personally that I couldn't sense the amount of life where I could on one end be like, I'm watching a performance, and on the other being like, I'm watching a real person, like, which is really amazing when you watch these two actors.
I had the sense too that a lot of it is ritualized. Mm-hmm. That a lot of their exchanges have been negotiated long before we got here. And they're not going through the motions exactly, but they are fulfilling a purpose. Mm-hmm. With every conversation. Mm-hmm. And shall I come to your bed? No, that sort of thing. They know where they're going, and they know that this is all agreed upon. Mm. And it's almost like we're just arriving 6 repetitions in. The loop has been going on long before we got there. And it's so strange that the film can create a situation where that is not only the logical assumption, mm-hmm. but the only valid one, because otherwise, why are they doing anything? Like, there must be a reason. We need to have a reason as an audience to be watching them. And so we impose that, or I impose that particular explanation, because it's the only thing that makes sense to me.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's so right. Like, it is satisfying to me too, because in my own films, I'm always interested in protocols and people following kind of rules and the way systems work, and that's definitely something that really drew me in the film. But I'd never quite really noticed it until I rewatched it a couple of days ago. But there's something about this system they have together that is, it's also a game that they sort of both agree to play. And something I noticed is that the moment he breaks up with her and he sits down on her sort of daybed and says, okay, I think we need to be separate, he instantly changes from vous, which he uses throughout the film, the sort of vouvoiement, more formal, which is again this kind of eroticized distance that I think he probably kind of revels in. And then he starts saying tu. It's like, okay, I think it's over. And it's just, and instantly she turns to tu also, and it's like, okay, so what's going on here? It's almost like they don't switch to complete naturalism. It's still this sort of stylized acting, but it's definitely more fluid.
Well, they've broken character.
They've broken character completely. And later on when she's in the car, she's actually driving at one point, which he's always the one who drives, and then she drives, and she also expresses like, okay, please just leave me be, or she says something like that. That is, again, feels like, oh, this is commentary outside of the game.
It's a violation of the contract.
Exactly.
Finally, for the first time, they seem to be saying what they mean and meaning what they say.
Absolutely. And they really articulate the themes of the film. He says, I want to know everything about you. I want to know what you think. And she's like, but if that's precisely what doesn't, if I knew everything about you, I wouldn't love you anymore. I need this sort of distance. But the truth is, I think he actually does not want that, because if he had that, he would leave her. He wants the mystery too, but it's sort of he's not completely aware of what he wants. He's kind of wandering around aimlessly sometimes. Like, it, and even the choice of actor, I was talking about that earlier. This guy Stanislas Mérard, this to me is such a perfect choice for this type of character, because he seems it's impossible to know what's on his mind.
Yeah, he's unreadable. He's not a limited actor, mm-hmm. but he just holds himself in such a way that he can't be read. I've been repeating myself, but he is just not. There are no indications. There's no sense of what his real desires are. He's mm-hmm. so still, and so he could be furious and hold himself together, mm-hmm. or he could simply be empty of effect and just not moving.
Yeah,
it's impossible to tell.
Yeah, he's like a ghost or a vampire. So he's just kind of roams around.
Even when he's in the water at the very end, you can't tell if he's swimming angrily or just because the current is strong.
Yeah,
there's no way to know.
Yeah, no, that's true. But I think that's why the film for me is so beautiful, and that again, it creates this sort of abstraction where, like, her character and her actions and her dialogue is impenetrable. We don't actually know what does she want, why is she in this relationship. But the actor herself, she's more contemporary than anyone else in the way she talks. Like, we kind of understand her as there's something more natural about her. She's very concrete. Mm-hmm. He's completely ethereal, but his actions are supposed to be completely clear. So they're both abstract in different ways. One is just the actor himself is completely unreadable, and her, it's just her character. And so together, they just kind of stay with you, but it's always like, why? Like, you keep asking, like, do they love each other? Like, what do they want?
You know? Yeah. Well, and you've worked with, in Fail to Appear, you've worked with an actor, Derek Campbell, who mm-hmm. I find equally mystifying because, and I'm sure that I've accidentally insulted her by describing this at least once. I know I have. She was in the room. In O Brazen Age, she does this thing. She has the amazing ability to level out her voice almost completely and yet still be completely open as to what it means, what her emotions and intentions are. Mm-hmm. I find that absolutely fascinating. I saw her do a live read of Reservoir Dogs a few mm-hmm. years back.
Oh, I saw that.
You were there.
I was there.
Yeah, well, she played Mr. Orange, the Tim Roth mm-hmm. character, and until Orange was revealed, she was absolutely soft-spoken, monotone, calm. Mm-hmm. And then as soon as The Secret was out, she just popped, you know, three gears forward into life all of a sudden.
Yeah.
And actors who can do that are remarkable because, at least to me, I find them absolutely hypnotic because I just want to see them. I want to mm-hmm. see more of what they're doing and try to understand what the trick is, but there probably isn't one. It's just how she does it.
Yeah.
But her measuredness, and it did, when you selected La Captive, I thought, oh yeah, that makes sense. There's a continuity there. There's a continuum.
Oh, for sure, yeah. And I think, yeah, Dara is extremely skilled at that, because she combines, and what I think it relates to what I was talking about earlier, this combination of naturalism and of control, where mm-hmm. she combines these two things, and I think that it's interesting because she won't, unless she feels it, she won't really she won't do a take, or she'll do it obviously, but she'll want to do it again, but in a way that I haven't quite seen with other actors. There's something that's very sort of there's a desire to project with actors in general, and to really show an emotion, and to just really kind of give you what they think you want, and to make it completely transparent, that she doesn't have. She doesn't feel that desire, and I think what she feels is, I don't really know what she feels, but she definitely makes things more interesting for me, at least, and more complex by containing things a little bit, but without removing the emotion. It's hard to describe. I mean,
but when you see it, it's electric.
Yeah,
it really is thrilling, and it happens in La Captive on both sides. Mm-hmm. But yeah, you're right. Sylvie Testud is so much more immediate, and her acting style is sort of unadorned.
Yeah.
In that it's not, he is doing something so small and precise that it's almost undetectable.
Yeah.
And it makes us look closer.
Yeah.
Whereas she is playing, to my mind, she's playing someone who is fully on board with whatever we're seeing, mm-hmm. even if we don't fully understand it, but also would really just like to be able to have a relationship without all the trappings.
Mm-hmm.
There's a sense that of the two of them, she is the one who would be more eager to get closer,
right?
On an emotional and just physical and every other level. She's constantly trying to nudge him towards a healthier version of what they're doing,
mm-hmm.
and he just won't register it.
Yeah. Oh, he's too complicated.
Yeah. Or
yeah.
He feels he is, anyway.
Yeah. Yeah. No. Definitely. And she, but what her strength is also that she makes this thing look normal in a way, because that's what also when you watch this film, I mean, after 10 minutes for me at least, I as absurd and as coded as this relationship is, I kind of get it, but I think I mainly get it because of her, because she, the way she reacts makes it look completely normal,
right?
Like, yeah, of
right.
course, yeah, I'll come to your bed if you want. No, like, there's something about her, he's just yeah, he's sort of in a state of perpetual hypnosis or something. he's a little bit more other in a way than she is. Yeah,
which again, I suppose, could make him more attractive.
Yeah,
no, if he's a mystery that she's trying to unlock.
Yeah,
just no, as much as we are.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's strange because so towards the end, when they sort of get outside of this game. And then he tries to go back in. I think maybe he tries to do it too soon or too fast or something. And that's when I think you really completely connect with her, because she's just kind of suffocating there in this hotel room. And he's like, we'll go on a trip in Venice. And maybe... And he even suggests to bring her friend, who is possibly her lover. And this weird question also of, like, does he know that they're possibly lovers? I mean, he clearly heard her say her name while she was climaxing with it, but he suggests, okay, we'll bring her, kind of knowing that this is kind of maybe what she would rather have.
He's just trying to be cool.
Yeah,
he's just trying to show her it's all right.
And I think that kind of throws her off, and she's just like, I need to take a swim.
yeah. I mean, and that is the moment, right? That's like, okay, you don't know what you're doing. This isn't healthy.
Mm-hmm.
That when she decides that she's out.
Yeah.
And then she disappears.
Yeah.
And she's simply gone because we're still locked into his perspective.
Oh, totally. So something I had not seen or I'd not paid attention to until I rewatched it recently is that when he swims to find her, he does find her. I don't know if you remember. And she pushes him away. And then it cuts.
That's right. Oh my God, that's right.
And but I completely forgot it, because you almost feel like the film would be perfect if she swam and didn't find her. I guess now I have really anything. but it's almost more interesting because she, he swims to her and she says no, but it's not clear that she wants to die. It's just clear that she doesn't want him to take her again.
Mm-hmm. God, I blocked that out completely, just because it's a better ending if she's gone.
No, you think so?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's starker, right? I mean, it's more representational of his... Or it's a better representation of his state of mind if she's completely gone.
Yeah. I mean, we kind of get that she's pushing him away without seeing her pushing him away in the water, maybe. Then that's true.
Yeah. It's still kind of hopeful, though, if she gets away and gets her own life somewhere else.
Yeah,
just one beach down, she's having a perfectly normal world, and he's trapped with himself.
I feel like she'll have to find another one like him, and he'll try to find another one like her. That's the problem. I think it will be never ending.
And that's an appropriate ending for Ackerman too,
right?
You know, people don't change, people don't grow, they're stuck with themselves.
No, absolutely.
Yeah, it's always fun. but that does bring us to the final question of the podcast, which is there anything specific in La Captive that you've used or borrowed or incorporated into your own work?
I think in in general about Ackerman films, I think something I mentioned earlier, this using cinema as a way to not trying to go necessarily underneath people's intentions or psychologies, but to sort of observe and to try to be faced with the visible world and all of its mystery and all of, you know, the things that we don't understand. I think that's what I take from her films, or at least I can see in what I do. I can sort of see where that influence comes from. Definitely this, yeah, this way of framing and of looking at things and looking at the world and allowing actors or performers to keep you know, this mystery and an element of unknown. Mm.
Yeah. I find your work a little more hopeful than hers.
Right.
I was going to say
thank you.
Yes. Well, she tends towards the despair.
Yeah.
And perhaps understandably, given her life, but it's the work of someone who is constantly disappointed by people.
Mm-hmm.
I always feel like she's hoping for the best for her characters, but it never gets there.
Mm-hmm.
And people solve their problems in her films with radical solutions. And mm-hmm. we're always watching the ends of relationships or the ends of stasis and people breaking free,
right.
Sometimes with violence, sometimes simply by leaving. But it's about, like, Captive is very much about someone reaching the end of his tether,
mm-hmm.
and then a woman completely detaching herself because of his disintegration.
Mm-hmm.
And she's I think they're both justified, she more than him, but it's still kind of not a hopeful ending because we're stuck with the character who can never change.
Right.
Your work is a little bit more hopeful, a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, I think I say thank you. Not, but I mean, I love her work and I love the fact that it is the way you've described it. It's just that I feel that way about my films, and I've often noticed that the reaction is not always what your reaction, that people can find it a bit more bleak. But I mean, in my new film, Fail to Appear, or even in the other films, I certainly don't see things ending for any characters or things kind of doomed in any way. I feel like even when I portray someone who is alone or goes about his routine, it could perhaps read a bit sad or bleak, but I personally enjoy being alone and I enjoy doing my things and doing my routine, and so showing someone that does that to me, at least, is not showing something that is sad or I think there's a common thread. I think in what I've done is that the people are always kind of trying to resist either some kind of specific circumstances or sometimes things that are a bit more abstract and internal, trying to resist Dara's character is trying to resist I think something, I'm not quite sure why, but you can see her in the way she works as a caseworker in the film, like she's trying to overcome something that's very personal.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's very noble and positive, and I kind of admire that about people. So I tend to think that, yeah, my work is definitely more optimistic.
Yeah. Well, and she's trying to do that so she can do her job and help someone.
Right.
It's an altruistic impulse that started the whole thing.
Right.
The reason she's there is to be of service to someone.
Yeah, no, totally. Yeah. And I think the admiration that I have for a character like this is that in the film she's this person who studied literature and who, through having empathy for the characters in the books she read, decides that this empathy should be used in real life. And the film is about how, well, real life is complicated and that might not be just that simple. But she does it and she's still doing it. I think a character like Simon in the film, like when he doesn't actually want to enter real life in a way. It's only through his head. Intellectually, that's the only way he can get this pleasure, and he's not seeking anything else.
Yeah.
I think even from the very first scene, he's he's playing this Super 8 film, and this is his moment of just, that's the only moment he smiles, I think, in the film, because he has the control over the footage. He can stop it and he can play it again, and it's not a real person, it's an image. Or when she's asleep is also the only other time when he can interact with her. So this thing where just not being able to deal with the real, and that I feel like, my films talk about something a bit different that involves the real, and so it's a bit more complicated, but also a bit less sad, I think.
Yeah, which is, I mean, it's a net positive for everyone, really.
Yeah. I mean, hopefully for her. I mean, it's a struggle for everyone to be in that space. I mean, I tend to be a little bit in my world, so I think that's also why I make these kind of films.
My thanks to Antoine Bourges, whose first feature, Failed to Appear, is streaming on Mubi right now, but only until tomorrow, Wednesday, June 6th, and opening in Toronto, Thursday, June 7th, for a week's run at the TIFF Bell Lightbox. See it if you can. It's a very precise, very simple film that builds a surprising power in its accumulation of details, and Derek Campbell and Nathan Roeder are very, very good in it. Antoine is not on Twitter, but you can keep an eye on Failed to Appear by following the MDFF account. MDFF, all one word. And as for La Captive, that might be even harder to keep track of. The North American DVD is currently out of print, although you can find it used on Amazon.com, and while the film is part of Fandor's streaming library, it's not currently available. Hopefully that means Criterion is working on a special edition. That'd be a good idea. As always, you can find me on Twitter at Norm Wilner, and elsewhere on the internet at NowToronto.com. You can also find this podcast on Twitter at Semcast, S-E-M-Cast, and on the web at SomeoneElsesMovie.com. If you feel like leaving a review on iTunes or Apple Podcasts, that would be greatly appreciated. Every little bit helps, it truly does. Thanks for your support, and thanks for listening.
All of those, I'm afraid you're just too darn loud.